live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have a lot to share today. We're going to talk about the power of berries and what it can do for you from the annals of neurology. We're also going to have a little more time to spend on understanding how to lengthen your telomeres. University of California has some new study on that and why you should pay attention. And how DHA, that's the active ingredient in your essential fatty acids, helps your brain. We're also going to look about sleep deprivation. It doesn't take much to really slam your immune system, and it actually mirrors physical stress. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine, and much more on health and healing. Then I'm going to talk about how music really impacts your brain. I'm also going to have a new report on the desertification of America. Now, this is important because most people are not aware when they move to a city because they like the weather, or there's something that really draws them there, like Phoenix, that it's becoming a desert. It will not reverse. It will get worse. In fact, I'll give you a list of the 11 cities and states that are now entering the desert state, meaning they are beyond arid, and they're not coming back, not in your lifetime or ever. So why move there? The trouble is almost no one thinks about sandstorms, dust storms. And you live at the higher altitudes, you're going to end up with the negative impact of dust from a state away that flew hundreds or a thousand miles, ended up on your mountain, covers your snow, and then has a darkening effect, meaning the bright snow allows the solar rays to bounce back into the universe. Now it won't. And that means that we're going to increase global warming at a really substantial rate. By the way, in one recent year in China, 12,000 towns or communities became desert. They were taken back by the desert. Something we're not talking about, but we should. Also today, I want to show you the people you're going to hear in a short clip are all former IRS agents. Not only just IRS agents, but some were fraud division IRS agents. They went after people for not filing their income tax. Now, of course, we know we have to file our corporate taxes and pay our school taxes and a lot of other taxes we pay. We pay over 60 different taxes, depending upon where you live and what you're purchasing. But the basis of most people's understanding is that our income tax, meaning taxing our personal income, is what pays for most of the government's expenses. What if I told you that not a single penny of our income tax pays for anything? Nothing. It all goes to the banks to pay the interest on the national debt. Well, hold on a second. Did these banks actually, through a proper fractional reserve, have the cash on hand to loan the government to pay for these bills? The answer is no. Well, isn't that a fraud? Isn't that a Ponzi scheme? Yes. And they have done it for years, for decades. So they're making money without actually investing anything. If you knew the full scope of this, you'd be outraged. Well, I'm going to show you one piece of the puzzle today. And all the people in this clip are all, remember this, they're all former IRS agents, including supervisors, and including one who was the former director. He ran the IRS. Wait till you hear what they have to say. Just stimulating some interest and conversation. And then the Great Depression as a best case scenario for what? You'll hear what that has to share. All this is to inspire us to think deeper and become more involved in the issues in our lives. We begin with health. According to Science Daily, an article in the Annals of Neurology talked about berries. Specifically, in this case, two, blueberries and strawberries. Why? Because they're very high in what I've spoken a lot about, flavonoids. And those in turn reduce cognitive decline. And that's very important because the results of our cognitive decline are substantial. Because once you start forgetting current memory, you may still have long-term memory. You might remember in great detail something from 30, 40 years ago. But if someone says, you saw a movie last night, yes. What was the title of it? I don't remember. You read a book? Yeah. What was the title? It skips my memory. What's that person's last name? Oh, it's on the end of my tongue. That's the beginning of cognitive decline and also evolving into what we would call this loss of cognition, which then leads to dementia. So the good news is that the flavonoids are compounds in plants that have powerful antioxidant, anti-inflammatory properties. All the science shows that stress and inflammation contribute to cognitive impairment, and that increasing consumption of flavonoids could mitigate the harmful effects, which means then that the more stressed you are, no matter what the source of stress, it could be emotional, physical, that you should increase the consumption of flavonoids or berries. Now, this is not the first study to do this. Many studies have shown positive effect of flavonoids, particularly the antho, A-N-T-H-O, cyanidins. These anthocyanidins are important. Now, you'll get them in grapes also, but they all have something in common. They improve cognitive function. So everyone over the age of 40 should be consuming more fruits or concentrates on a daily basis of these fruits. So that's a good study. Now, they also found that people whose minds wander, that's associated with aging cells. There's a study done at the University of California, San Francisco, and they're looking at our attention and the length of our telomeres. You can say, well, first of all, what does one have to do with the other? The telomeres are proteins that are on the ends of our chromosomes that hold that chromosome together. And when they start to shorten or unravel, that cell dies. The more things you do that cause that shortening or speeding up of the telomeres shortening, the faster that particular cell line dies. So if you're smoking, your heart, your lungs, your eyes, and your skin all are going to quicken. They're going to die much ahead of some of the other cells in your body. If you drink alcohol, you've really speeded up the decline of the telomeres in your kidneys, your liver, your heart, and your brain. So everything ages separately. Every single system in your body has its own biological clock. So that brings me to the idea that if we are not conscious in our focus, if we're always wandering with our mind, if there's no sense of intellectual discipline, if there's no meditative discipline, then it more often than not indicates unhappiness. Whereas a mind that is present in the moment indicates more well-being. You really should, if you ever have a chance in your life, visit some of the cultures where the Jain society is influential or Buddhism is influential. These are individuals who have highly disciplined minds. And there's a high level of satisfaction with life, contentment, and happiness. There's also better health, longer lifespans. And in our society, we go just in the opposite direction. We want to do what we want to do, only to the degree we want to do it. When anything becomes uncomfortable, we stop doing it. and hence we're lacking that discipline. Not individuals, individuals certainly can, but as a society. So when we take a look at our telomeres, if we're disciplined, we wouldn't be taking in the pro-inflammatory agents that speed up the shortening of our telomeres. Here's your deadly dozen list. They can quicken your death, speed up your aging process. Top of the list, beef, chicken, pork, and fish. Behind that, alcohol, sugar, refined carbohydrates like pretzels and pizzas and breads, those things, unless they're Nassim bread. Also, lack of exercise, stress, and a toxic environment. Those would be the things that really speed it up. There are more, but those are the worst offenders. I mean, polluted water that accumulates with all these chemicals, toxic environment, background radiation, being close to the computer or cell phone and getting the non-ionizing radiation, the magnetic fields that they're throwing off and how that impacts the telomeres. So in essence, the telomere length, which is an emerging biomarker for cellular and general bodily aging, was assessed in association with the tendency to be present, meaning mindful in the moment, versus the tendency just to mind wander. And they looked at hundreds of healthy midlife women, and being present in the moment was defined as an inclination to be focused on current tasks, while mind wandering was defined as the inclination to have thoughts about things other than the present or being elsewhere. And this was sponsored by the Association for Psychological Science, and the journal Clinical Psychological Science published it. And what they found was that if you're mindful, your telomeres are healthier. The telomeres, again, are the DNA caps that protect the ends of chromosomes, preventing them from deteriorating or fusing with neighboring chromosomes. And telomeres typically shorten with age. And in response to psychological and physical stressors, they really speed up. And in research pioneered at University of California at San Francisco, scientists have discovered that telomere shortness predicts early disease, and early death. So if you begin to be more mindful, if you use mindful meditation interventions, that'll promote attention on the present with a compassionate attitude of acceptance, and that leads to increases in some aspects of health. So for those who would sit in class and their mind would be all over the place, if you're in class, pay attention. When you're out of class, choose what you want to focus on. It could literally add years to your life. We should be taking in the essential fatty acids, but most people are not aware that there is one fraction of that fatty acid, whether it's vegan, like from avocados or walnuts or flax seeds, or from fish, that is important. That's called DHA. And according to the Journal of Applied Physiology and Metabolism, University of Alberta in Edmonton provided an explanation for the ability of the DHA, it's also in algae, by the way, to support memory. A team led by a Professor Savi, who is a member of the University of Alberta's Faculty of Medicine, received a diet supplement with DHA or a placebo, and they found that there was 29% higher levels of DHA in the brain's hippocampus region. By the way, that the hippocampus is where memory is focused, and it made a big difference. So when you're taking your supplements, make sure you're getting your DHA, which is a part of your essential fatty acids. It's going to help your brain. And finally, sleep deprivation is big in the United States. Wow. For a lot of reasons and with a whole lot of different causes, We have a lot of people who have sleep deprivation for the reason that they eat too late at night. That artificially turns on their metabolism. Or those who have lighter sound in the room that keeps them up because they're listening. And the light keeps the brain from turning into a sleep catabolic state. Or they have been close to, or still are, a cell phone or computer or laptop. And so the electromagnetic pulses are disrupting the pineal gland and the secretion of melatonin. Or they go to bed distressed. They got things on their mind. Whatever your reason for being sleep deprived, it makes an enormous difference to your immune system. A study looked at white blood cell counts following wakefulness versus sleep. In severe sleep loss, jolts the immune system into action, reflecting the same type of immediate response shown during exposure to extreme stress. So, the conclusion was, quote, future research will reveal that molecular mechanisms behind this immediate stress response and elucidate its role in the development of diseases associated with chronic sleep loss. So what they're saying here is your immune system, like your granulocytes, they take a beating when you're not getting sleep. So if you are stressed and you're not sleeping, you have a double negative. In which case, you better pay attention to how you can get a good night's sleep. And the best way of getting a good night's sleep is stay at least 8 feet away from any electric device. Don't have anything to eat within 3 hours going to sleep. Make sure that you have a little soft eye pad that if you have light in the room or background room light, and use an earplug if you need to. And then just write down all the things you want to accomplish the next day that are stressing you. So you write it down, just number, like number one, must deal with reduction in rent. Two, and then just go down the list. Because what you're doing, you're tricking the brain, because you're dealing with it then and will further it tomorrow. So you don't have to deal with it now when you need to sleep. It makes a big difference. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief music break and come right back at you with the environment. Please stay with us.
When this whole world starts getting me down and people are just too much for me to face, I climb way up to the top of the stairs and all right into space.
I did mention that I wanted to mention something about the brain, and your brain on music is important because your favorite songs may regenerate your brain and act as the ultimate adaptogen. That's according to new research presented on GreenMed Info by Sarah G. But in lay language, it just means that music, which may be the most ancient human language, has the potential to improve neurodegenerative and neuropsychiatric disorders by creating new brain cells and neural connectivity. Not only that, but music restores hormonal and immunological balance in a way mirroring adaptogenic herbs like ginseng, for example. And music, universal language, has been woven into the fabric of human culture since time immemorial. And rather than being a modern human invention, the creation of musical harmonies, using the voice as an instrument and moving to rhythms, may have long been crystallized as part of the human condition. In a historical facet of the human condition, research implicates music in the cementing of social bonds, the establishment of monogamy, and as a primitive mode of communication. In fact, by forging social communion and engendering a sense of group identity, music may have been foundational to the emergence of large-scale pre-human civilizations. So when Homo sapiens arrived in Europe 40,000 years ago, they drove the Neanderthals, one of our hominid cousins, to extinction. And archaeological evidence demonstrates that the arrival of Homo sapiens coincided with the time to which elaborate art-adoring caves found in southwestern France and northern Italy has been dated, as well as other artistic expressions such as carved figurines and symbolic artifacts and sophisticated bone and ivory musical instruments. And while some researchers argue that music may have contributed to the social cohesion that led Homo sapiens to dominate over Neanderthal cousins, there are many flaws in that particular logic, as Neanderthal instruments may have been made from perishable objects which were not subject to preservation. However, archaeologists have surmised that a more primitive human relative, as well as Neanderthals, had access to at least one instrument at their disposal, the human voice, and their fossils contain a bone known as the hyoid at the anatomical position resembling that of contemporary humans, which means that their voice boxes were descended enough to allow speech and singing, and this implies that singing conferred some sort of evolutionary advantage, the nature of which has been hotly contested. And one promising theory advanced by those who believe this is that primitive song mediated the transmission of emotional states at a larger scale than physical grooming. So, something to consider. And by the way, I find that when I play soft, very meditative music, the animals that I have rescued and getting back to health, they're very calm. And then allowing animals to groom each other, finding them if they're alone, and frequently someone will just tie an animal to the front of my gate, not even a note on it. And the poor things are abused, frequently dehydrated, malnourished. And one of the things I try to do is find another one that they can bond with, because grooming in all cultures is an extraordinarily important way of showing an expression of fondness. In our society, we don't do a lot of grooming. We should, but we don't. But animals can groom, and that shows the bond. Just something from the past I thought was interesting to share with you. Now, from our environmental segment, and I'm going to be doing a major environmental white paper discussion in the next week or two, I'm seeing just one piece of our problem that I believe deserves some attention. That is that we're running out of water. We're running low on water. Even though we may have torrential flooding and rain and hurricanes dropping trillion gallons of water over Houston, for example, and hundreds of billions over Florida, that does not mean that that water actually benefits. It runs off. So 95% is lost. Here are the cities, according to the latest science, that are running out of water. And here are the worst. The worst city in the United States is Los Angeles. It's running out of water. Next would be Houston. That's the fourth largest city in the United States, by the way. San Francisco, San Antonio, El Paso, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Miami, Cleveland, Lincoln, Nebraska, and Salt Lake City. Those are the ones that are under such enormous stress, and yet you won't hear a word about it. If you go to buy a piece of property, nobody will say a word. I now have a map of the rate of withdrawal of water from the aquifers, whether they're historic aquifers that cannot be recharged or they can be recharged. The country that is using more water and is withdrawing it faster than any other in the world, United States and Alaska. Also South Africa, India, all of Australia, the Western Mediterranean, North Africa, and some of the Baltic states. the countries that do not have a problem, all of Russia, Canada, Greenland, Iceland, and most of South America, and at least 70% of Africa, they're not using a lot of water. That doesn't mean they have plenty of water, they're just not using it. One of the things that we should know in the United States is our largest aquifer here is the Ogallala. That's a big aquifer. It was laid down about 11 million years ago by fluvial deposition from streams that flowed eastward from the Rocky Mountains during the Pliocene epoch. And the Ogallala is an aquifer that virtually is all based upon recharge, meaning the only water it's getting are rainwater and snowmelt. It provides 8 states with lots of water. It covers about 174,000 square miles. Let me just put it so you can better understand it. If you spread the aquifer, the Ogallala, that's Ogallala, across the United States, the aquifer would cover all 50 states for 1.5 feet of water. If drained, it would take more than 6,000 years to refill it. And about 90% of the water is pumped used for irrigation. It is literally under the breadbasket of America. It supplies at least 1/5 of the total annual U.S. agricultural harvest, or $20 billion a year, in food and fiber depend upon that aquifer. And yet, we're losing water out there because no one is managing it. Now, we do not know when it will go so low that it won't be able to be used, but you have to understand the topography. The topography means that there is a slope where there's a gravitational pull to one direction, and each aquifer has its own unique hydrodynamics. So some states already are having a hard time getting any water out of it. In some areas, you can't get any water at all, and others are okay. But this is all what we originally called fossil water. And these aquifers actually hold a lot of water, but we're using about 325 billion gallons a year, meaning this water lost 325 billion a year. It's not being replenished from rains and snows. And they measured over 100-foot decline in water in just one area. In western Kansas, the state suffering the most from low water levels, studies in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences show that the aquifer is not going to look good for the future. Not tomorrow, but in the future. And aquifers have their own physical and geological properties. And so if you live in, let's say, based upon solely on physics, if you lived in western Kansas, you're suffering. But western Nebraska is fine, where the hydraulic conditions are more favorable. Now, there are 64 aquifer systems in the United States, and 30 of them account for 94% of the total water withdrawals. And the largest amount of groundwater, about 56,900 million gallons per day across the United States, is used. And it's used for irrigation. Next would be the public, and that's about 16 million gallons per day. And then industry is about 3,500 million gallons a day. And worldwide, most of the aquifers are actually pretty good. The ones that are worst now are Northern Arabian countries, like the Northern Arabian aquifer in Saudi Arabia. It is the best example of how stupid conservation works. Why? Because the Saudis drilled in and turned the dunes green with grain. All right, everybody applauded them. Look, they're greening the desert. Yes, for 20 years. In the 1980s and 90s, but now the aquifer is almost totally empty. So last year, there was zero wheat that was planted. So what did Saudi Arabia do? It took those hundreds of billions of dollars and went to other countries. Oh, in other states, Arizona grows alfalfa, for Saudi Arabia as does California. So they're having long-term leases to grow their own food outside their own country. Also in bad shape is the enormous Upper Ganges aquifer in India. Then the Western Mexico aquifer, the Persian aquifer straddling Iraq and Iran, going dry. And then our High Plains aquifer, including Ogallala in the United States. And you've got, you have a lot of aquifer problems in Europe, mainly Romania, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, Bosnia, etc. China's large North China aquifer is not doing well. And the world's largest aquifers are in Russia and Siberia. They're fine. And the U.S. Floridian aquifer, that's the Florida along the East Coast, it also will help with Georgia, South Carolina, Mississippi, and Alabama. They're in good shape because there's so darn much rain. So on the one hand, it depends upon where you live. If you live in the wrong area, you're going to have a lot of dryness. You're going to have drought. And now you see the desertification, which states are going to be deserts. Now, it doesn't mean you can't live in a desert. You can. But when we hit 2 degrees increase, and we will shortly, then you will find 130-degree days to be normal. You won't have any local water. You'll have to bring it in from hundreds, if not thousands of miles on major water projects, and those will always be privatized so someone can charge whatever you want or they want, and you have to pay it if you want their water. Just in the state of Texas alone, right now, there are over 1,200 communities that are water-deprived. And one of those communities, Houston. If you were down there during the hurricane and post-hurricane to this day, you would have a hard time finding clean water because the wells were flooded. That meant that they were toxic. They had to be shocked out. And all the water pipes were flooded with sewage debris. Those all had to be shocked out. And they may get them back to where people can drink the water. But would I ever drink that water? Never. Because having a background, as I do in the sciences, they give parts per billion or parts per million of allowed contaminants in the water. I don't want any of those parts at all. So we're moving into the wrong areas that are not sustainable. Now, that's just water and the desertification. Now, put on top of that, when you have desertification, you're going to have fires. And just look what we've had in the last 3 months. The worst fires in California history burned more communities in northern and southern California. How many homes was it? I think it was 50,000 were destroyed. I know there were 5,000 in one area, Southern California. You had the worst fire in Montana's history, in Washington State, in Oregon. And now that means that when rain does come, it's going to cause all new grass to grow. That'll go dry, and that'll just create a cycle. So we should really pay attention to what is possible, where can we live and where can we not. We're going to take a break and come back, and I'm going to have a special commentary. Please stay with us. I want to thank Les Jamison from our audience for bringing us up to date on not just being on the show last week, but also how bad this extension of 702 of the FISA Act is. I'm going to be doing more on upcoming programs of how we become a full fascist police state. Every single email, phone call, text, photograph is monitored and collected. They're now putting, they actually, I had this on my, in around desert communities, they build artificial cactus or listening devices and filming. People would not know it. Who gave them the right? Why would they assume that the average American is a threat to national security and therefore want to spy on them? And people think, well, I didn't do anything wrong. I have nothing to fear. Yeah, I can show you an awful lot of people who thought that was true in China, Russia, Germany, Brazil, Argentina, Colombia, and the United States. They were wrong. The government should never have that kind of power over us. Right now, they have their boot on everyone's neck. And as long as you're one of them, or supported by them, or supporters of them, it's not your neck that the boot's on. So we want to look at what is happening. And what is happening is that if you're concerned about mass surveillance, about what whistleblower Edward Snowden revealed, everybody should know. But before Edward Snowden, there was the National Security Agency whistleblowers, William Binney, Ed Loomis, Kirk Wiebe, Thomas Drake, and a congressional staffer named Diana O'Rourke. And the documentary, A Good American, produced by Oliver Stone, tells their story, which everyone must learn. And here's the bottom line. They report that the National Security Agency has the capacity to prevent a 9/11, should have prevented 9/11. The intel agencies haven't averted a single attack since. So, and it's all set up to fail. Why? Now there's a move happening in Congress to legalize and expand the intelligence agency's access to everyone's data. So starting today, we need millions of people to put Congress on notice that the National Security Agency must be investigated, and they must uphold their oath to uphold the Constitution, specifically the Fourth Amendment. So I'm going to give you an email address that will give you a lot more information. This is too long an email address. I'll try to get a shorter one. It's about a page long. No one would go on it. Les Jamison, give me a short email address, and I'll be happy to share it. But I'll keep everyone up to date so that you can inform your legislator you do not want this. You do not want us being spied upon. Now a short commentary. If anyone in the audience has access to Tucker Carlson or to any of his staff or producers, please share this, because even though on many topics I share difference of opinion with Tucker, I do respect him for having the strength of character to take on all opponents on important issues. And whether you accept or reject his particular side, very few people have that open forum. He does. And the other day, he had on a person, a professor, talking about the travesty of post-Libya, of what kind of debacle it turned out to be, and how they're slave trading there now. And I've posted pictures of the slaves being tortured and sold in the public market, and how thriving a business it is. And that's what they talked about. However, what they did not mention at all was why Libya was in this condition in the first place. And they may still be under the impression, because it was all propaganda, that Libya and its strongman Gaddafi deserved to be invaded, that he was killing his own people, which was not true, or he had used poison gas, and that is also not true. Seymour Hersh proved that not once but twice in two separate articles. These were false flags. And then when they gave Academy Award to the short documentary The White Helmets, and Amy Goodman Mock Chanel had him on and promoted the documentary, and also asked for regime change in Syria, we had on real reporters who told the truth. Eva Bartlett, who was in the war zone while it was in the hands of ISIS and al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and the so-called Syrian Liberation Army. And she told the truth that the White Helmets were a terrorist organization. And hundreds of millions of dollars were being given to it, as well as these terrorist organizations. So we presented a different point of view. But when it came to Libya, everyone still thinks that somehow Libya was a bad place. It was almost like a prison for its people. Please share this with Tucker Carlson, because I believe if shown the truth, he will act upon it. First, I want to tell you the accurate story of life under Gaddafi. Gaddafi inherited one of Africa's poorest nations in 1967, but he turned it into Africa's wealthiest number one state before his death. It had the highest human development index and the lowest infant mortality rate. It had the highest and longest life expectancies and the highest standard of living of all of Africa, better than South Africa. And Gaddafi noted on many occasions that the Libyan revolution had a sacred duty to help all those who were in legitimate need and suffering persecution. Most people do not understand the nuance of that. And I want you to understand the nuance of that. In any case, there were a lot of people who were engaged in regime change. And that's important to understand. Gaddafi was against regime change. Gaddafi was against the U.S. and other countries meddling in the sovereign nations and the democratic nations of Africa and other countries as well. And so Libya created what was called the Libyan Revolution that was based upon the sacred duty to help all those who were in legitimate need and suffering persecution. And since this was in accordance with the teachings of the Quran, which was Libya's constitution, and the word Mathaba, established by Muammar Gaddafi in 1982, had as its stated mission, quote, to resist imperialism, racism, fascism, Zionism, colonialism, and neocolonialism. So the Mathaba denotes a place where people gather for a noble purpose. And based in Libya, it became a meeting place for revolutionary and progressive forces from all over the world, similar to the House of Wisdom in Baghdad, which became a major intellectual center during the Islamic Golden Age, and the University of Sankore in Timbuktu, where scholars of the day converged to discuss and debate ideas and formulate new ideas. And the Mathaba became a forum for the advancement of a third universal theory beyond capitalism and beyond communism. So through the Mathaba, Gaddafi assisted all those who were fighting for liberation and self-determination, regardless of whether or not it was Libya's geopolitical interest to do so. He gave material assistance and moral support and was provided to the oppressed from every corner of the earth, regardless of religion or ideology. And all were helped, from the Roma people of Eastern Europe to the Kanak people of New Caledonia in the Southwest Pacific to the Rohingya people who are presently being ethnically cleansed in Myanmar. Gaddafi created a unique form of government. And while being a kind of socialist military dictator, Gaddafi was also one of the world's most democratic nations. Libya was, I should say. Because the people, and this is important to understand, the people held power directly through various committees and congresses that voted among themselves and interacted with the central government. It was far more decentralized than our own government or any a government in Europe. And he built a new society. And this new society, Jamahiriya, a state of the masses, a democracy based upon the revolutionary teachings of the Quran, which according to South African political scientist Themba Sona, created conditions for the many to rule themselves. So when Gaddafi invited the New York Times to visit Libya and witness Libyan democracy in 2009, the Times wrote, this is the New York Times, quote, Everyone is involved in every decision. Tens of thousands of people take part in local community meetings to discuss issues and vote on everything from foreign treaties to building schools. That was in the New York Times. And there were literally hundreds of committees throughout the country that any Libyan citizen could participate in. And although there were no presidential elections, that could have removed Gaddafi or vote for or against a wealthy elite, as in the United States or other Western nations, Libyan democratic model enabled every ordinary citizen to make decisions regarding foreign and international and domestic and economic policies themselves. And terrorism and terrorist organizations were completely non-existent. In fact, in 2009, Hillary Clinton's own State Department called Libya, quote, an important ally in the war on terrorism, end quote. And now, how in the world could we be complimenting Libya for its advancement and giving up supporting the support of others who have been oppressed? So we said, well, he's supporting terrorism. Okay, now go in and do your homework and find out who these people were and who had occupied their countries, who had invaded their countries, who had engaged in regime change. Then you'll have a broader, more honest understanding of what he was actually supporting. But he said he's going to give all that up. And he did. He gave it all up. But here's what happened. Before Gaddafi, Libyans only had an educational level that 25% were literate at all. Today, after Gaddafi, it's 87% are literate. 25% of all those have college degrees. His greatest crime to Washington was his putting the interests of domestic labor above foreign capital and his quest to create a United States of Africa. And Libya had lots of money and resources to pursue it. He nationalized the oil wealth to create a sustainable, progressive social welfare system for all Libyans. And Libya had no foreign debt, zero, and actually deposited payments from oil revenue into the bank accounts of every one of its citizens. Free health care, free education, free electricity, free interest, free loans. Libya was ranked at number one in health care in Africa. If Libya could not provide certain medical care for treatments or pursue a particular educational program, the government would find you a place and fund your entire overseas trip. Even if you had to spend 8 years going to college, they would pay for it. He was the first Muslim leader to pass a law in 1970 for equal pay between men and women. Women had a right of education, a right of jobs, a right of divorce, and a right to own property. Half of university graduates were women. The UN Human Rights Council praised Gaddafi on his promotion of women's rights. But hold on, Hillary Clinton said she's for women's rights. Yeah, she supported Walmart against women workers. And she supported having clothes made in Bangladesh, Walmart clothes, as slave labor. Gaddafi freed women from any of the historical or religious burdens of being second-class citizens, the only country to do so. Women in Libya had more rights as Muslims than any other women in any other country in the world. And if you were unable to find employment after graduation, the state paid the average salary of the profession until you were able to find it. So if you had gotten a doctorate or master's degree in business and there was no job, the government paid you what you would have made had you been working until you found work. Libya built the world's largest irrigation system, what was called the Great Man-Made River Project, that made water available through the country and to at least 7 other surrounding nations, like Chad and Egypt and Algeria, etc. He also, farmers were given land free, a house free, equipment free, and seeds free to start a farm. Owning a home was considered a basic fundamental human right and should be and not have any middlemen. Newlyweds receive $60,000 a year, which is $50,000, to buy their first apartment and help start a family. A portion of Libyan oil sales was credited directly to every Libyan citizen's bank account. A mother giving birth received $5,000. The government would pay 50% of any new car purchase. And by the way, 15 cents could buy you loaves of bread. How many? 40 loaves of bread for 15 cents. So they had the highest standard of living, the best education, the most freedom, and were more prosperous, had complete health care and no terrorists. Why kill him? Why destroy his country? One of the 3,000 Hillary Clinton emails released by the State Department revealed evidence that NATO's plot to overthrow Gaddafi was fueled by, first, their desire to quash the gold-backed African currency, and second, the Libyan oil reserves. The email identifies French President Nicolas Sarkozy as leading the attack on Libya with five specific purposes in mind: to obtain Libyan oil, to ensure French influence in the region, to increase Sarkozy's reputation domestically, to assert French military power, and to prevent Gaddafi's influence in what is considered Francophone Africa. And most astounding is the lengthy section in the emails delineating the huge threat that Gaddafi's gold and silver reserves, estimated 143 tons of gold and a similar amount of silver, posed to the French franc, circulating as a prime African currency. So life after Gaddafi, NATO called its mission against Gaddafi its most successful operation in history. Well, all Western nations have removed their embassies. South Libya is a haven of ISIS and Al-Qaeda terrorists, recruiting and training camps. The North Coast is now a center for trafficking of migrants. Egypt and Algeria and Tunisia have all closed their borders. The current head of ISIS in Libya, who is a dude, according to Fox investigation, he was courted by the Obama administration and members of Congress at one time and was a staunch U.S. ally in the quest to remove Gaddafi. And Senator McCain called him a, quote, heroic freedom fighter. No, McCain, I'm sorry you're senile, sir, but he is a terrorist. It's a haven for terrorism, widespread rape and torture, militias, killing at want, and explosion of religious fundamentalism. All the universities shut down. All the social programs are gone. And under the pro-Islamic regime, women's rights are gone. Increased U.S. military assistance, which is there. And then Obama confiscated $30 billion of Libyans' money and stole it. So, something to think about. Now, I'm just told that we have some people on the phone. Let's go over and say hello to Nancy. Hi, Nancy.
Hello, Gary.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
You just spent a month at the retreat. Tell us your improvements, please.
Yes. Okay. Well, first of all, I just want to say, and I think I said this before, but I want to just thank you again for welcoming us all into your home. And it was just, you had very great patience with all of us. And I know some of us, it took a little longer than others. And I just want to thank you for having that patience and probably more faith in us than we had in ourselves. I'm getting choked up. That was a very, very great gift from you. So thank you. Some of the things that I've just changes or whatever that I've carried on with me, I'm continuing every day, living each day. Something that you had said to me that, you know, just you wake up every day and you just do it. And you do what you have to do to accomplish my goals. And just to be disciplined every day. So every day I wake up with that in mind. I think I've probably become annoying to some people because every other sentence out of my mouth is, well, Gary says this and Gary said that. So I might have to taper that a little because I think I might be getting annoying to people. But you are in my head and I'm trying to keep you there so that each day I'm focused.
Nancy, what's the biggest single change that has happened?
I think that my mindset on food has changed. I know you you know, and your audience doesn't, but I had a great struggle with that for many years. I have a switch in my head. I was never a vegan. I was, you know, always a meat eater and all that. Not only, you know, there's times that I'm thinking in my head that, oh, I want this. And then I think, no, because I'm thinking how it impacts the environment now. And I'm also thinking of how it impacts my body. And I'm thinking of how it impacts the actual animals. So I have a mind and a heart change. I've also been keeping up with different vegan sites and such to keep my my focus there every day to have that becoming part of my being. And, you know, I went through the holiday, the Thanksgiving. You know, I had planned, I said, well, you know, it's the holiday, and if I think I'm going to have turkey, you know, I'm going to just have it this one time. And I didn't have that desire. I didn't want to do it. I will say that I did have a few things that were not part of my program as far as, you know, going off a little bit. And that's a lesson, too, and a good one, because I felt it right away. So anybody out there, once you get clean and you're following Gary's protocols, my energy level is something I haven't had in years. I'm able to go through the day without having that constant afternoon tiredness where I would want to sleep and just not have a motivation or desire to do things. Now, by eating the right way, I have so much more energy. I've also really gotten on the ball. You know, clutter is a major issue in my life, and I've been, since I came back, I'm really focusing and working on that. And you know, I do have an issue with holding on to things, and I'm getting better at that now. I'm working every day. You know, we've been working on different areas, and I'm trying to let go and release things. And so that feels real good too.
Nancy, how much weight have you lost?
About 25 pounds. Right
That's
now
great.
I'm having an issue because I don't have the exercise going, because I have gotten a terrible heel spur and plantar fasciitis situation going on. So I've been out to acupuncture three times a week and such, but that'll come back again once that's over.
Nancy, I'm gonna have to say goodbye because we're out of time. I still have Saul, but good luck, and I will touch base in about a month to see if you're continuing. I know you will be, all right?
Much, and I will be.
Sal, I'm sorry, we got to put you in at the end here. Sal, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling pretty good, Gary. I just got a report from the doctor's office. They did a CAT scan of me last Thursday, and my tumors are shrinking. I was just stage 4 lung cancer patient going into the retreat, and now I'm a guy with shrinking lung tumors. I mean, that's amazing. That's a complete reversal of the situation, you know. And my energy is much better. My sister-in-law, who I live with, my brother Lenny, looked at me when I came back. She says, you look like a different guy, you know. So I joined the gym a couple of weeks ago, too. So now I'm going to the gym twice a week and working with a trainer. And I told her about the weight you wanted me to put on. And she asked for a copy of Luann's book so she could read into the whole theory of diet, you know, theory. And because I told her I had to eat certain things, and there's a lot of things I can't eat. You know, and I've been sticking to that.
So we're out of time, Sal. Just real quick, you came with terminal end-stage cancer, given up, and you had a short time to live. You're now saying that as of this last Thursday, the CAT scans at the hospital show that your tumor is reversing.
It's reversing. That's right. It's shrinking.
Great. We'll look forward to another conversation a month from now. We'll have more time for you, and let's see if it hasn't reversed a lot more. All right?
Thanks, Gary. Yeah.
Thank you. And those two people spent a month with me, and I only worked a month with people who had medically irreversible conditions. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.